Good morning.
Morning.
Thomas Cameron, appearing on behalf of Mr. Markinson, and I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. And unfortunately, I'm sure everyone knows that the state Supreme Court did not decide case today.
They did not.
So we are going forward.
Yeah. There's sort of, in answer to the question, why are we here if they might do our work for us?
Well, I would never ask that, Judge
okay.
Blair.
Well, there's three things in mind that's playing on. The first is, as shocking as this may be, sometimes they decide cases in a manner that doesn't answer the cases that we have waiting for them and that we anticipate are going to get answered. And so in the spirit of keeping things moving, that's one. Two, there's a question whether or not we should try and shift that playing field if they're in dispute with one another, if that's what's taking by pushing out a decision in this case or not. And then the third is, of late, appellate costs have become always argued about in writing but never argued about at argument. And this is an opportunity to hear from both sides of recurring competitors in those discussion on as to what we should be doing with regard to that. So those are our three.
Okay. So I get a sense that the court wants to hear on both issues, or is the court more interested in the cost issue as opposed to?
No, I think both. I don't mean to.
Okay.
Yeah.
Obviously, Mr. Markinson was convicted of 2 counts of felony violation of no contact order. He stipulated to the existence of the 2 prior no contact orders. He did not stipulate to the whether those NCOs were valid or were issued pursuant to the relevant RCWs.
But he stipulated. So now the crux of the issue is, was case correctly decided or wrongly decided?
Exactly. Or should this court agree with case or?
Well, that would be the correctly. I mean, if it was correctly decided, we would agree. Or was it wrongly decided?
Or a different way of deciding.
Oh, okay, that's right. So you could give us a number three way. But I understood you to be adhering to the decision in case.
Exactly.
So I think it's an either or.
I tend to agree. Our argument is that case doesn't control, but case is persuasive enough that this court should follow case. And I think the important distinction here that takes us out of Carmen and Gray and the whole waiver argument is case relied on the Supreme Court decision in Miller. Now, Miller adopts Carmen, but the portion about waiver is not part of that. They adopt the analysis about whether or not the prior convictions are elements. They don't say anything about waiver. They talk about the trial court's independent gatekeeping function. And that's what case relies on. And that appears to be something other than an evidentiary objection that's required. This is something the trial court is required to do even when there's a stipulation, as in case, that the court has to determine that the no contact order, the prior no contact orders, were issued pursuant to the relevant RCWs. And it didn't happen here. Now, of course, in Miller, defense counsel objected up, down, sideways every time he could. Here, there was no objection, as in case. The facts here are virtually mirror case. And so our point is Miller talks about something different than an evidentiary objection. The trial court has an independent duty. It didn't do it here. Therefore, the prior convictions were inadmissible, and there's not sufficient evidence to support the 2 counts. In the short time I have, switching quickly to the cost issue, Sinclair talks about this court's decision in Sinclair seems to be what everyone's talking about these days, and that's certainly what
we're talking about. Well, that's because the Supreme Court denied review.
Exactly. There's the whole RAP 15.2.2 that continuing indigency. So, you know, our clients, especially Mr. Markinson here, has been found indigent. There's a presumption that that's going to continue unless there's something in the record that points that suddenly he's now got an ability to pay. And there's nothing in the record that shows he's his circumstances have changed other than the fact that he's been in prison, which certainly inhibits one's ability to find employment. So from our standpoint, we've made a sufficient showing to ask this court, certainly to use its discretion, to deny costs on appeal. Any questions? I'll reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Stephanie Guthrie, Deputy Prosecuting Attorney for King County on behalf of the State of Washington. This court should hold that Mr. Markinson's convictions are supported by sufficient evidence. The defendant's argument is not truly a sufficiency argument. It's an evidentiary error argument. As this court has recently reaffirmed and the Supreme Court has said, sufficiency of the evidence looks at only whether the evidence admitted at trial is sufficient for a jury to, or a fact finder to find the essential elements of the crime.
Well, what cases are you citing?
The one that comes to mind, though it has not been cited in this briefing, is State v. Tyler, very recently authored by Judge Dwyer, and referring to the United States versus Musacchio. But all of the case law about the standard for sufficiency makes clear that it's about the elements of the offense, the essential elements of the offense. And the parties are in agreement here that the statutory authority for the previously violated orders is not an element of the offense. There's no dispute that the evidence the jury heard was sufficient for the jury to find the elements beyond reasonable doubt. That disposes of any sufficiency claim. The true claim the defendant is implicitly making here, as in Case, is that the trial court should not have allowed the jury to hear the stipulation absent a proper showing being made. And that's an evidentiary.
Well, isn't it that the trial court should not have accepted the stipulation?
Yes, I think I'm using that interchangeably. I think accepting the stipulation, clearly if it's not accepted, the jury will not hear it. I don't know if it clearly, yes, it's basically the same thing. The judge should not have accepted the stipulation or allowed the jury to hear about it. I think they're more or less one and the same. And that is essentially a decision about what evidence, whether the evidence is a stipulation or something extrinsic, should the jury be allowed to hear. There are multiple reasons why that claim fails here, three procedural ones and one substantive one. First of all, the defendant has not assigned error to the trial court's acceptance of the stipulation and allowing it to be read to the jury. Second of all, the defendant invited that alleged error. He explicitly wanted the jury to hear the stipulation, explicitly asked that it be sent back to the jury room during deliberations. Had he not invited the error, he waived it. It's very clear under Evidence Rule 103, RAP 2.5, and State v. Gray that an evidentiary error has to be objected to at the time it's made or it can't be raised on appeal. And in State v. Gray, this court specifically held that this exact same type of objection as to whether the prior orders were the right kind of order was waived if it's not objected to at the time the jury hears that information, or before that time. So here, this is not something that can be raised for the first time on appeal. And frankly,
well, what is it that the trial court would be looking at? And I mean that literally. In its quest to determine whether that thing would be admissible.
I think if the circumstances were such that the trial court needed to decide whether the prior convictions were admissible, which I contend is not the case here, presumably if there were not a stipulation, the state would presumably be offering the judgment and sentence,
okay, right,
which might itself indicate what the statutory authority for the,
right,
the prior orders were.
So the state did not seek to enter a judgment and sentence in this case?
No, because frankly, the stipulation not only removed the state's obligation to do so, it removed the state's right to submit that evidence to the jury. This, under Old Chief, the state has no right to submit the substantive conviction to the jury if the defendant offers to stipulate to the information necessary for the jury to evaluate the element of the offense, which both in Old Chief and in this case leaves out certain important information. In Old Chief, it was what was the actual crime committed as opposed to just the level of crime. Here, you know, it's what is the statutory authority for the previously violated order. But in both cases, once the defendant offers to stipulate to sufficient information for the jury's purposes, the state has no right to introduce that conviction. And yet, having removed the state's ability to offer that evidence, the defendant is nonetheless asserting the state somehow had an obligation to prove that that evidence was admissible. There's no basis in case law or statute to argue that the state must establish the admissibility of evidence that it
so
may not
introduce. It's not really an evidentiary ruling because there wasn't any evidence.
It's evidence in the sense that the stipulation becomes evidence for the jury's purposes.
No, but the inquiry into whether a stipulation is proper is a different inquiry from whether a judgment and sentence should be admitted, right? I mean, does the defendant want to do it?
Right. Yes.
Do they
clearly
agree? I mean, is it a factual matter for the jury rather than a legal question? All of those things.
In that sense, yes. But the claim the defendant is raising is essentially based on the admissibility of the evidence that the stipulation was replacing, and he's somehow arguing that the state had to establish that the evidence it would have offered in the absence of a stipulation was admissible before
the trial
court.
Well, he's not somehow arguing it. He's directly arguing it, and he's happy because he's got a case from Division II named case that says he's right.
Which, respectfully, I have to disagree with Division II. I think they went badly awry, both in ignoring the waiver aspect of State v. Gray, which it otherwise claimed to agree with. And frankly, I think the point at which Division II went astray is the moment that they framed the sufficiency analysis without mentioning the elements of the crime. State v. Case framed it as, you know, whether a reasonable fact finder could have found the fact at issue beyond a reasonable doubt without acknowledging that sufficiency looks at whether the jury could have found the elements of the offense.
What's the Jackson standard? You know this off the top of your head. What's the Jackson standard?
Whether the evidence is sufficient for a reasonable fact finder to find the essential elements of the crime beyond a reasonable doubt.
Okay. And so the quandary that Case puts us in is that the focus was not on the fact finder.
Right. The
focus was on the trial judge.
Exactly. And the focus is on what the trial judge should have or should not have allowed the jury to hear. But that's exactly the kind of issue. I mean, that's essentially by nature, an evidentiary issue, the trial court's decision to allow the jury to hear certain information. And that's exactly the kind of decision that ER 103 and State v. Gray say has to be objected to at the time.
Does Miller step back from that view that this is akin to a preliminary determination of a foundation matter, an evidentiary matter, and recognize some other non-evidentiary form of gatekeeping function for the court?
Absolutely not. I think there is no basis in Miller or any subsequent case law to conclude that Miller's discussion of a gatekeeping function is anything other than another word for the court's function of determining the admissibility of information and evidence. Miller uses the phrase gatekeeping function, but then in subsequent sentences makes it very clear that what they're talking about is the determination of, is this admissible or not? Because they said, you know, it's the gatekeeping function, and that if the prior, I guess in that case, Miller was specifically talking about the validity of that specific order, you know, if the order cannot support a conviction, it should not be admitted, which I think makes very clear that they are using gatekeeping function to mean the court's role in determining whether evidence should be admitted. And that's why there's no basis to say that this isn't something that needs to be objected to at the time, that this is somehow different.
Do you want to make us more informed on your office's view with regard to the cost kerfuffle that is constantly going on?
I can certainly try, Your Honor. I was not anticipating that the court would actually want to hear on this issue, but unfortunately, I was searching my phone. This court recently issued a published opinion, and the name is escaping me, in which it, I think, very properly noted that the critical issue in whether it is inappropriate to impose appellate costs is whether the defendant can pay the costs at the time the state seeks to enforce that obligation, that it is completely speculative to say that just because a defendant who was indigent at sentencing, that they will never be able to pay costs or they have no likely future ability to meet that obligation. And for that reason, the court, in that opinion, chose...
It was Shelton.
Was it Shelton?
I think.
Anyway, I apologize. I wish I had it at the tip of my tongue. But I think that case, I think that opinion had the right analysis because, first of all, this is not actually a typical case because here the record actually does not support a finding of indigency. The trial court apparently made that finding based on no facts whatsoever. So in this case, normally, in most cases, there is support for the original finding of indigency. Here we actually, for reasons unknown, have zero evidence, and therefore the trial court, in this case, actually was wrong in the first instance to ever find the defendant indigent, and therefore there's no basis to continue to do so. Thank you.
Thank you. I think with your reserve time, you're back up to 4.5. Let's run it at 4.
I'm certainly not going to use that much.
One of the things that's unusual about this case is this is the only time I can recall where the state actually assigned error to a finding of indigency, which sort of, so the Kmart light was
exactly.
Flashing in terms of who gets to come here and talk to us.
Exactly,
about stuff,
exactly. So. It is a kerfuffle. I like that term. Obviously, the Supreme Court is extremely interested in indigent, the ability of indigent people to pay costs and these onerous costs that are hanging over their head for so long.
That's Blazina.
That's Blazina.
But this is different.
I understand we're talking about two different situations, but you can conflate the two because you're putting a person who may only have $600 in costs from the trial court because of an understanding of indigency. But now you're going to slap them with, you know, a minimum these days of $3,000 or more for appellate costs when they have a constitutional right to appeal. So they honor their right and they go through the process and they happen to lose, and that's not surprising. And now all of a sudden they're looking at this unbelievably onerous debt that they owe that's going to follow them forever and continue to grow at a 12% annual rate, which is crazy. So I mean, that's part of the whole problem that's out there. And like I say, the Supreme Court certainly is very much interested.
What are our options? Are we restricted to heads or tails?
Well, that's, you know, given where we're at here in the Court of Appeals and there's no hearing, there's no evidentiary hearing, seemingly one way is to remand it back to the trial court for a hearing on whether or not the person has the ability to pay.
Pitchforks and flames on the ends of poles coming up from 3rd and James.
I think that was sort of the process when they decided to impose the statute in the first place. So... But, you know, that's an option. Send it back to the trial court where you can actually have a hearing. You know, you can't do it here, but you could do it there and come up with, you know, use GR-34 to determine whether or not the person is indigent and can never pay.
Well, other than philosophical, in this case, there is an assignment of error on indigency. So
GR-15.2 seems to indicate that it's continued indigency that...
Well, I think there's a challenge to the initial determination, so should we remand on that question?
Well, if there was no assignment of error to it or cross appeal, then how do you get there? It seems like since it's not challenged, it's essentially a verity.
I could be wrong, but I thought there was an assignment of error.
I don't believe there was. But if there was, seemingly that would be something to remand as well.
Without the pitchforks, it would just be one case.
Just determine indigency. I mean, I understand for Judge Schindler, you being a prior Superior Court judge, and you, Judge Dwyer, being a prior District Court judge, frequently it's easier just to sign the order of indigency and move it on because the person does have a constitutional right to appeal, mm-hmm. and it's just easier that way. But maybe it is a scenario where you send it back and determine under GR 34 whether or not the person is indigent in the first place. I don't know.
And Superior Court.
That's true. We were there for a cup of coffee. So we would just ask the court
It got cold. So.
That's what I'm getting for my cup of coffee. We would just ask this court to reverse Mr. Markinson's convictions and or not order costs. So.
Thank you for assisting us.
Thank you all. That concludes this morning's session.